Hey, it's Jordan. All this week leading up to International Women's Day on Friday, we're bringing you stories of amazing women, issues of equality and sexism, and discussions that we need to be having. We just don't need me to lead them. So please enjoy the work of my supremely talented colleagues. I'll be back next week. We'll talk then.
With the advent of Me Too in late 2017, there's been a lot of conversation and increased awareness about what constitutes sexual assault and harassment. But a recent article in the Toronto Star made me realize how much work is still left to be done. In the piece, Work and Wealth reporter Zara Mashtahed-Zadeh explores how Ontario's Workplace Safety and Insurance Board defines, or more precisely doesn't define, harassment, as laid out in a 2018 ruling on a chronic mental health claim. I found it to be shocking, and I think you will too. I'm Maureen Halushak, editor-in-chief of Chatelaine magazine, in today for Jordan Heath Rawlings on the week of International Women's Day. This is The Big Story. For background, in 2018, the WSIB extended benefits to workers who had gotten sick after long-term harassment or trauma on the job, which sounds really great on the offset, but then you hear about a 2008 audit on chronic mental health claims, and that paints a bit of a different story, that even though they are looking at these claims now and looking at them retroactively, are they really approving any of them?
Yeah, so this is a new policy that the board introduced earlier in 2018. And since that time, the numbers show that they've denied 94% of chronic mental stress claims. So it's very difficult, although workers do now have the right to claim for mental injuries as a result of long-term harassment or other issues in their workplace. The ability to actually win something for it, whether it's benefits or medical treatment, is pretty elusive for a lot of people.
And what's the process for filing for chronic mental health stress claims?
So the WSIB has three criteria that you have to meet. So one of them is you obviously need to be diagnosed by a health professional as having a mental health issue. The second is that you have to be able to show that it's related to your workplace. And then you also have to be able to show that the workplace was actually the predominant cause of your mental health issues. So the critics of the policy say, like, yes, it's great that workers are now entitled to chronic mental stress, but the test that they have to meet for a lot of people is pretty insurmountable. And it's actually different than the test that workers have to meet when they have a physical injury. When you have a physical injury, you have to show to the board that the workplace was a significant contributing factor, but it doesn't need to be the predominant cause of your disability or injury. So, yeah, the critics of the chronic mental health policy say this speaks to a pretty outdated view of mental health as being somehow different than a physical disability or injury.
Who is Marjorie Wardell? Can you tell us a bit about her and her claims to the WSIB?
Yeah, so the claims date back to a set of incidents, or I guess a series of behaviors that took place in the 90s, actually. So I'm stemming back quite a while now. But essentially, she was a public works worker with then the city of Nepean. I believe that she was the first woman to hold this kind of job.
She was a heavy machinery operator.
Yeah, and so a very male-dominated field, especially in the 90s. And the types of behaviors that her claim said she was subjected to were comments from her colleagues about her sexuality, her sexual orientation, pornography being distributed in the workplace, unwanted physical contact, and at one point it sort of culminated with her being out on a job at a hockey arena and being swarmed by members of the public who were taunting her and making comments about her sexual orientation. So she was eventually diagnosed with a number of mental health disorders as a result. And she filed a claim once workers became eligible last year to file claims for chronic mental stress, and recently she was denied. And the decision that I saw didn't dispute what had happened in the workplace, but it basically said that it didn't rise to the level of what would be considered workplace harassment, I guess, in the eyes of the board, and so she was denied.
And that's so shocking and frustrating. I think one of the things that she says she experienced that really shocked me the most was that men followed her into the women's bathroom,
mm-hmm.
and that wasn't deemed harassment.
Yeah, I mean, there was just the response to that in the board's decision was just that the women's bathroom was easier for the men to access. So, like, just didn't really address the key issue, which is obviously that would be quite, like, an intimidating behavior to have to encounter on the job, and I think all of us as women would probably feel uncomfortable with that happening. But it does speak to some of the caveats in the board's policy. So the board does not consider, it will not approve you for a chronic mental stress claim if it feels that the behaviors that you're encountering are just like interpersonal conflict in the workplace or normal levels of stress that you should expect to encounter in the workplace. And it won't compensate you if the mental health injuries stem from things like discipline or termination or like things basically that you don't like that your employer is doing. You have to show that like that there's harassment or abuse consistently on the job. I guess the issue is how do you determine when something reaches the level of workplace harassment or is just normal for your job. Like if you work in a really toxic workplace, then harassment might be considered normal in that culture, but that doesn't mean that legally it's acceptable.
Especially I think in the 90s, we weren't as well educated about what constitutes harassment. Does the WSIB have a definition of harassment that they work with?
So the WSIB is bound or works within the context of the Ontario Human Rights Commission. So it is required to take the principles and the definitions that the Human Rights Commission puts forth on things like harassment. And when you know, I'm not a lawyer, so obviously I can't make a legalistic judgment on Marjorie's claim. But when you read what the Ontario Human Rights Commission says about what constitutes sexual harassment, I mean, Marjorie's case, as she describes it in her claim, ticks pretty much every box. It's things like unwanted contact, pornography in the workplace, a poisoned work environment, unwanted comments about your sexuality or sexual orientation. So it really does fit a lot of the criteria that the Human Rights Commission puts forward. And so, you know, that was definitely a question that Marjorie's lawyers had when her claim was denied is, if this fits the Human Rights Code definition of what sexual harassment is, why isn't it being accepted?
And to go back to the time that the harassment started, so this was in the 90s, and I believe Marjorie was more precariously employed at that time. Mm-hmm. She was on contract. She wasn't full-time. And she, I believe as well, didn't report this until she gained more secure employment with the city. Is that right?
Well, that was what the board said in their decision. I think that Marjorie's account of things is a little bit different. She said that she did pretty consistently try and raise it with her managers. And it's at one point, her managers did sort of make some motions to try and improve things in the workplace. And I think told people, you know, to cut it out or whatever. But then what happened was the city of Nepean and the city of Ottawa merged. And the sort of layer of management that had been kind of working with her to try and improve things basically got eradicated. And in fact, some of the people who she'd had difficulties with in the workplace got promoted into management positions. And she says that's when kind of the reprisal began. And I believe that sort of becoming permanent, like, coincided with all these changes happening. But, I mean, to use that as a way to kind of dismiss her claim, like, if you're precariously employed, obviously it's going to be very difficult to speak out about harassment in your workplace. So, you know, I think that certainly raises questions as to, you know, what more vulnerable workers are going to do if they encounter this this type of behavior in the workplace? Like, is it going to be counted against them that they don't report it, even though there may be very valid fears of reprisal?
100%. And do you think Marjorie's story is getting adequate attention right now in the media? Because to me, it's just such an infuriating case. And it's something that every person, but also every woman, should care about. If you have a job in Ontario, you want to know that you have a right to benefits from WSIB if you are experiencing long-term chronic mental health issues because of your work. And it doesn't matter if you're a heavy machinery operator or an engineer or a teacher. Like, you need to know that you can access these benefits. You are paying into them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when the story was published, it definitely resonated with our readers. Like, I got a lot of emails from women who said they'd experienced similar things to Marjorie in the workplace. I got several emails from people who said they'd had difficulties getting their chronic mental stress claims approved. But I think that more broadly, there is a lack of understanding about how the workers' compensation system works. And so maybe, like, a lot of people don't necessarily engage with it, but it is important to understand how the system works because it's part of our social safety net, really. Like, if you're injured on the job, this is, like, one recourse for you.
And regardless of whether you're precariously employed or full-time employed.
Yeah. I mean, there are some, like, particular barriers for people who are precariously employed, but, you know, you should know what your rights are when it comes to getting compensated on the job. The workers' compensation system is actually funded by employers, so it's not funded by the taxpayer. But it's there to compensate you if you're injured on the job in exchange for, like, losing your right to sue your employer if you file a claim. But the idea is that it's supposed to be easier than taking your employer to court, which can be financially very draining and difficult for people. But the other thing that the workers' compensation system is there to do is to try and make workplaces safer by tracking employers' accident records and sort of matching their insurance premiums that they pay, which fund the whole system, to their accident records. So if your accident record is really bad, your insurance premiums are going to go up. And what that means is that employers should be incentivized to try and keep workers safe on the job, and that includes being psychologically safe. And if the board is denying a lot of mental health-related claims, it means we're not getting an accurate picture of the psychological risks and strains that workers are facing on the job, and it means we're not incentivizing employers to address those risks.
And with Marjorie's case in particular, it seems like we talk about Me Too this past year and a half. There has been so much talk about coming forward and sharing your stories and hopefully emboldening women to do so. Do you think that Me Too has been more effective for women in other fields, like blue-collar fields? Maybe there's less light shed on these issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a certain amount of privilege in feeling confident and secure enough to be able to come forward with those sorts of complaints in the workplace, not to diminish the women who do that, because regardless, it's obviously incredibly brave and a difficult thing to do. But I do think that there are many women in the workplace who feel completely unable to articulate those kinds of challenges. And it's obviously so important that if you are in a position where you do feel you're able to voice some of those concerns, that can definitely empower others to do the same. And so I think it's really great that, you know, women in Hollywood or wherever it is, choose to stand up and articulate those issues. But it's also important to recognize, I think, the structural barriers that would prevent, say, like a domestic worker from speaking out. And I know that, you know, the Me Too movement has tried quite hard, I think, to try and raise those voices as well and to make sure that women of all classes are able to have a space and a platform to articulate those concerns. But the fact remains that while we have jobs that are not sometimes fully protected under employment laws, which is the case in Ontario for sure, and face other structural barriers like simple things like applying for workers' compensation, that is going to disincentivize women in those jobs from stepping forward because those barriers are so huge to overcome. So I think it's important to address the kind of bigger reasons that are preventing or blocking women from speaking out.
And I think it's amazing that Marjorie came forward and started speaking to her supervisors in the 90s when there wasn't as much education around harassment. And I think something now that we're becoming more educated on is that harassment is such a spectrum. It can happen to you. Harassment and assault can be so many different things. And I think that sometimes people don't realize that, and that could also hold them back from coming forward.
Yeah, and I think like one thing that she told me was that one of the reasons she decided to start speaking up was because she was seeing younger women come into the workplace and experience the same kind of behavior. So I do think it's really amazing that she had the courage to step forward and to try and improve things, not just for herself, but for the other women in her workplace. But yeah, I think there really is a lack of understanding as to how sexual harassment can manifest itself. And when you actually do read what the Human Rights Commission has to say about it, it's so much more subtle than just being, say, grabbed in the workplace by someone, which obviously would be completely uncontentious and unacceptable. But there's like a whole spectrum of behaviors leading up to that that can make you feel uncomfortable, that can make you feel targeted, can make you feel discriminated against, that might be harder to articulate. And so, yeah, I think it's important to recognize these sort of more subtle ways that people can feel disempowered in the workplace.
And power structure as well is something I think we're becoming to understand better and better. But perhaps in Marjorie's case, I don't know this for certain, but if someone who was harassing her was more senior than her at work, I think that also would create a huge hesitation in coming forward, yeah, as it would for anyone.
Yeah, and that is a big thing when it comes to anything related to the workplace, is that the workplace is a fundamentally unequal environment. There is almost always a huge disparity in the power that an employer wields compared to the power that an employee wields, which is why, you know, we have tools to try and address that, whether it's our employment protections or unions or, you know, a workers association, whatever tool you choose to use, those can be effective in trying to, like, minimize those disparities. But in the most precarious jobs, or in very male-dominated sectors, for example, I think that those disparities exist or have existed for a long time without being checked in a lot of cases.
It's really boys will be boys, and I'm sure that is what some of that behavior likely would have been written off as in the 90s.
Yeah.
In Marjorie's case.
And I think, again, it goes back to, like, part of the problem with this whole chronic mental stress policy is, you know, that it doesn't recognize stressors that are part of a normal work environment. And like you say, what is a normal work environment? If the attitude is boys just will be boys and that's normal, then, like, no one is ever going to get a claim approved. And I'm not suggesting that that's necessarily the approach that the board is taking, but it's sort of a slippery slope. And I think that, yeah, we need to think long and hard about, like, what we're passing off more generally as normal behavior in the workplace.
And what I found so heartbreaking about Marjorie's case is that ultimately she left her job, and she said that it was a job that she truly loved. And that just really breaks my heart for her.
Yeah, and I think that people's jobs are such a big part of their identity. And, you know, from speaking to her, I know that she, like, really valued that job, that she was so proud to be a woman in this blue-collar field, to be one of the first women to occupy that position. It was a real source of pride. And I think that there's sort of this misconception or narrative that when workers file compensation claims or are injured, that, like, there's some kind of nefarious reason behind it, that they just don't want to work or whatever. And I think that's such a harmful and untrue, in most cases, sort of form of stigma, because people, for the most part, like, I've been doing my job for more than 4 years, and, like, I'm always wowed by how much people's jobs feeds into their sense of purpose and identity, and how much they really value their jobs as more than just a way to put food on the table. So I think losing that and losing it in those kinds of circumstances can be really devastating for people. And again, it sort of turns into this downward spiral if you're already experiencing mental health challenges.
What's next for Marjorie?
Well, she and her lawyer are intending to appeal the board's decision. So that appeal process can take some time. So I'm not sure when we're going to see a final resolution. But I do think, you know, she's spoken out on a number of occasions now And so I think, yeah, I think she's doing a great job kind of advocating for workers who have experienced similar things to her. And yeah, again, that's a hard thing to do. So I think it's great that she's kind of occupying that space.
She's definitely someone to celebrate and send strength to in this week of International Women's Day. Did you hear from the WSIB after your piece or after the Star's editorial that also came out against the way this case was handled?
I didn't. They did speak to me for the piece itself. And they, you know, they obviously are encouraging workers who do have chronic mental health, mental stress claims to come forward. But they haven't said that they're going to be addressing some of the criticism that's been raised about how the policy actually works in practice. So whether there's internal discussions about that, I don't know. I think there was probably a fear when they first introduced the policy that it would lead to this inundation of claims. You know, there's separate to all this, there's already concerns from frontline staff about their ability to manage the workload, their workload at the board. So maybe there were, you know, well-founded fears that they would be inundated and be unable to cope with the volume of claims that they were going to see as a result of this new policy. But we haven't seen that materialize. And either way, the board does have a duty to provide, you know, fair adjudication on the claims, regardless of what's going on internally. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know where they're going to take it, but I guess we'll find out in the next little while.
Zara Mashtahadzadeh, work and wealth reporter at the Toronto Star. That was The Big Story, celebrating women every day this week ahead of International Women's Day. For more, visit thebigstorypodcast.ca or on Twitter at @thebigstoryfpn. I'm Maureen Halushak. Thanks for listening.